This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Over the past week, as part of our North Carolina Voices series, we've looked back at the Civil War, gathered stories, talked to experts and historians, and today, the legend of Henry Barry Lowry. Henry Lowry was a Lumbee Indian, sometimes described as the Robin Hood of Robeson County. But Lowry's story is much more nuanced than that. He's a hero to some, a murderer to others. All told, Lowry and his followers were responsible for some 24 killings at the end of the Civil War and during Reconstruction. Joining me today is Melinda Maynor Lowry. She's an assistant professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill and a Robeson County native. She also produced 3 documentary films and written a book about her Lumbee heritage. Melinda, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Also with us, Josephine Humphreys, author of 4 novels, including the historical novel about Henry Barry Lowry called Nowhere Else on Earth. Thanks so much for being here, Josephine.
Glad to be here.
Melinda, before we start, we should talk a little bit about your name is Lowry. You are related. Tell us about your relationship with the legendary.
Well, I'm a Lowry by marriage, actually, but I am related to Henry Barry on both sides of my family. My great-great-grandfather on my father's side was Henry Barry's half-brother, and then my great-great-grandfather on my mother's side was Henry Barry's first cousin, Henderson Oxendine, and Henderson is a major figure in Joe's book. And was also the only member of the Lowry gang to be publicly executed in 1871.
So tell us about Henry Barry Lowry. Who was he?
He was a man of mystery. He was one of those kind of inaccessible folks who doesn't say a lot but speaks with his actions. And he was born in 1846 in Robeson County, the son of Alan and Mary Lowry. His story really starts with the story of his parents. His parents were the type of people who intentionally grew enough food to redistribute to their neighbors when the neighbors didn't have any food. And they were among the wealthiest Indians in Robeson County, probably the wealthiest. And Alan was a prominent member of the Methodist Church, but in the 1830s, the Methodist Church, which at that time was integrated, asked the Lowry family to sit in the balcony of the church with the slaves. And they, not being slaves, not being African Americans, and feeling that they deserved equal treatment, refused. And so they left the Methodist Church that their family had attended for generations. And in some ways, back then, way back in the 1830s, that kind of began, I think, Alan's own convictions, his social and political convictions, that Indians, whites, and blacks all ought to be treated equally. And so if you were in need, it didn't matter what kind of race you were, what kind of color you were, you could go to Alan and Mary's house and receive food or whatever you wanted. So that was the kind of place that Henry Barry grew up in.
Now, Josephine, tell us a little bit about your novel. You decided to fictionalize his life, but the characters in it were based on real characters, real people.
Yeah. This is a story that I first heard as a teenager when I was 17 years old, and I salted it away thinking, this is just the best story I've ever run across with connections to the American South. And I knew then that I wanted to be a writer, but I thought if I could only someday tell this story, that's what I would most like to do. And it took me a really long time to get around to doing it because I didn't know any history. And I wasn't even that particularly interested in history. I was, you know, a fiction writer and had dodged every history class I could in college and high school. So
history's so boring.
It was boring then.
Well, this stuff, though, is pretty complicated history, right?
And it was very complicated. And there was not much of a written record.
Yeah.
And this was also long before the internet. But finally, in my 40s, I decided I needed to at least attempt this. What I liked about this story was it had so many elements of just a plain, great narrative. It had a hero. It had a romance. But for me, it also had implications for the whole history of Southern race and our cultures and everything that I'd always been interested in sort of concentrated together in the story of Henry and Rhoda.
Melinda, tell us a little bit about the conditions for Lumbee's during the Civil War.
Well, Joe describes this wonderfully in her book and some of the opening chapters, how deprived people were. When the Confederacy realized they could not ask Indians to fight because they had prohibited them from owning weapons, they began to draft or conscript Indian boys to go to Fort Fisher in Wilmington and help build the fort. And so that basically left many, many Indian households without men to plow and without people to participate, give their share of the labor to maintain fields and crops and hunt and do the kinds of things that men did. So women took over a lot, and women have always taken on a lot in Lumbee society. But economically, the particular conditions of being conscripted to go to Fort Fisher left us in pretty dire straits. And so it meant that families like Henry Berry's family had to take on an even greater share of the burden to feed their neighbors. When Henry Berry's brothers and Henry Berry himself became a target of these conscription efforts, he and his brothers, who were mostly teenagers at the time or in their early 20s, went to lay out, as they said, in the swamps. They were hiding out in the swamps that pervaded the county at the time. I mean, there was maybe one road in Robeson County at that time. And so it was very hard to get around and hard for wealth to be distributed, to be shipped in and out, as it were. So when Henry Berry and his brothers and cousins and later in-laws were lying out in the swamps, they were essentially forced to raid farms for food, not just to feed themselves, but again to feed the starving people in their community. And so when Alan and Mary's own resources began to dwindle, Henry Berry and his group, which by that point was multiracial, they had been joined by escaped Union soldiers from a Confederate prison in Florence, South Carolina. These escapees would travel north and find these great hideouts in the swamps of Robeson County.
And by some local whites.
And local whites as well.
And a couple of blacks.
And local whites hiding out from the war?
Probably deserters who otherwise resisted service. Local whites who didn't have to go but were also, you know, committed to trying to feed their folks.
And or who were just, like Zach McLaughlin was just a neighbor and a friend, and I don't think I never read anything that said he was a deserter. Or
me neither. I think he was too young to have fought in the war, and so he was a neighbor, a friend, someone who probably looked up to Henry Berry, and saw the need and knew that there were plenty of planters with plenty to feed themselves who were not giving adequately.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Now, when you get to the Robin Hood part of this, I really want to figure out how much of that is real, how much they were doing just to feed themselves. Because if you're taking it from farms and giving it to farms, who are you taking it from? They're all seem to be in the same boat, or were they?
Well, not everybody was in the same boat. So one of the things that really precipitated what we call the formal Lowry War was this raid that Henry Berry and his brothers and Zach McLaughlin and several of their black neighbors committed against a lady named Elizabeth McNair on the Argyle Plantation. Now, that plantation was so large and well-known and wealthy that it had its own railroad stop. And so because of its railroad stop, it also became a kind of a socializing place for Confederate officers. One night, they were having a party, I think, and they were surrounded. The house essentially was surrounded by Lowry and his Confederates, as they said, the bandits. And Elizabeth McNair had hundreds of acres of land, dozens and dozens of slaves. I'm not sure how many she owned, but she was among the largest slave owners in the county as well. And several thousand pounds of meat in her smokehouse. So you have to think that's a pretty large wealth disparity between people who are starving and people who are hoarding thousands of pounds of meat. So on this, you know, Henry Berry knew about this plantation and knew about Ms. McNair. And on this particular night, he and his gang surrounded the house. And with all these Confederate officers, 20-some Confederate officers inside, engaged them in a gun battle for food. And the Confederate officers were, you know, defeated soundly by this band of ruffians, essentially. And so Henry Berry, you know, commandeered one of Ms. McNair's wagons, loaded up some food, loaded up some corn and other stores of vegetables and produce, took them back to, as we called it, Scuffletown, as they called it, Scuffletown, and then redistributed it. And meanwhile, he returned the wagon to Ms. McNair.
And when was that?
I think that was in February of 1865, so it was a couple of weeks before
most of this
Allen's death.
Sort of outbreak of robberies and raids came at the end of the war. And that the last year of the war was a very strange and wild time from everything that I read. When and the Lowrys were essentially Union sympathizers, even, although I don't think they were spies as they were once accused of being. But they knew, everyone knew, that the war was winding down and going to be over soon. And so there was an increased lawlessness, especially on the part of slaves who knew they were about to be delivered in a way.
And so Sherman was on his way.
Sherman was
from South Carolina.
Anxiety is rising. Tension is rising. There is a kind of homeland security force, and we'll talk about that and how that all played into the picture and the legend of Henry Barry Lowry as my conversation continues with my guests Melinda Maynor Lowry and Josephine Humphreys. Please stay with us on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about Henry Barry Lowry, a Lumbee Indian folk hero from the Civil War period. Lowry's band of vigilante justice made him one of vigilante group, actually, made him one of the most hunted men in North Carolina's history. We have with us Melinda Maynor Lowry, a history professor at UNC, a native of Robeson County. Josephine Humphreys is with us as well. She has written about Henry Barry Lowry in her historic novel, Nowhere Else on Earth. Josephine, tell us about that novel. You've chosen as the narrator Rhoda Strong.
Yes.
Tell us about her and how you came to choose her as the narrator.
I spent a lot of time trying to choose somebody. That moment when you have to commit to a perspective in the narrative is very tough because after that there's no going back. But in fact, I did go back because I started writing from the point of view of Amanda McCabe, who's the white school teacher in this story.
Her real name was Amanda Nash.
You're going to reveal the secret identity.
Maybe I will.
But you had to make her a Mac, right? Because that's what
yes,
that was the prevailing.
That's right. So it was a logical choice because I was a white school teacher anyway, so it was she was me. But she was extremely boring, and the narrative as it came out was uninteresting to me. And I thought, why do this if it's not going to be as fascinating to me as in the written form as it is in real life? So I switched to Rhoda Strong. Always wondering, how can I, am I going to be able to identify closely enough with her and to understand her in order to rely on her as a narrator for this entire story.
Well, tell us who she was.
She was a cousin of Henry Lowry, second or third cousin.
Probably.
And his sweetheart. And when the book opens, she's 15 years old. The war is in its last year. I really was interested in thinking about the story from the perspective of a woman who is really a girl at the beginning and grows up in the process of what happens to her. But I thought a lot and read a lot about girls in wartime and the loss of the dream, because war eats up young men and destroys the countryside and people's normal dreams can't come true. So that's sort of how I began with her. And I did feel as if I got to know her, although that's a metaphor. Of course, I didn't, and she's still mysterious to me. But interestingly enough, when I came to sort of flesh her out, because there's not a lot of written material about Rhoda, she appears in the book North Carolina Women, and I think it's one page. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of fact. Mm-hmm. But the luckiest thing that happened to me while I was writing this book, sort of in the middle of it, was that I met the most wonderful Lumbee woman who befriended me, supported me, encouraged me, and struck me as the kind of person that Rhoda herself would have been. Incredibly strong, really smart, funny, generous. And that person I used a lot in making Rhoda. And she also happens to be the mother of Melinda Lowry.
Hey, Ma. You're listening.
She's listening. Louise Maynor.
She's brilliant.
She's brilliant, and she's the goodest-hearted person, if goodest is a word.
It is now, yeah.
That I have ever known in my life. Yeah. And I could never have done this without her in a lot of different ways. But she also gave me a way into the Lumbee community. She took me to Pembroke. She showed me the river. She introduced me to people and took me to family reunions and the annual powwow, and I got to meet Melinda. And
well, I'm really interested too in so now you're gaining a voice, you're hearing the voice, and really
yes.
able to write. And the story itself is, as you say, riveting. And part of the story we haven't even talked about yet is the Home Guard and a character, the character of Brantley Harris.
Yes.
So tell us about him and the Home Guard.
The Home Guard was, as you mentioned, sort of Homeland Security Force during the Civil War. And it was made up, as I understand it, of men who either didn't qualify to serve in the Army or who had paid their way out.
But
these were the men who, the white men, who were left at home to maintain security and in some cases to help with conscription. Mm-hmm. And Brant Harris was part of the Home Guard, and he was the conscription officer.
He weighed about 225 pounds.
He was a big man.
He was elephantine, as William Mickey Evans says about him in his book, To Die Game.
What was also interesting about him is that nobody liked him. He was a perfect villain for me because I didn't worry about alienating anybody by casting
Nobody's going to be
him.
Offended.
Right. He was evidently quite a bad guy and wealthy.
He was
made
a womanizer.
A lot of money.
He was legendary in the Indian community for abusing women, raping them, sexually molesting them, abducting them,
holding them prisoner,
torturing them, really. And I think he enters Henry Barry's life at a moment when an advantageous moment for the Indian community, for sure, in a way, because we got an opportunity to rid ourselves of Brant Harris.
And tell us how that came about. How did that happen?
Well, he had, if I remember correctly, he had been responsible for the deaths of Henry's
three of his first cousins,
who were the sons of George Lowry, Alan's brother, and he killed them. And Henry did not do anything about that right away, which I thought is an interesting thing. You know, he wasn't the kind of person who simply ran out and shot in revenge.
No, they were killed probably in the fall of 1864. They were on their way, well, at home on leave from having served in Fort Fisher. Hmm. And they had furlough papers. They were there legitimately. But Brant Harris went on some kind of, you know, tear and decided that they were going to get sent back. Well, on their way to get, quote-unquote, sent back, he decided to shoot them and kill them. But it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't until several months later, mm-hmm. that Henry Barry decided to act.
At that point, and when he did, of course, then he became a hunted man. Was he before this? Did everybody know who was leading these other raids? And was he hunted or not? Because
that's
a lot of the
question.
Countryside is really living off the...
Well, everything's in chaos, as Joe pointed out here towards the end of the war in the last year. And so there's dozens of raids that occur in Robeson County that are documented in manuscript collections. And Henry Barry Lowry gets a reputation for committing them, but in fact, it's very unclear who committed a lot of these things. And of course, because there are so many different people hiding in the swamps for several different reasons, it's almost impossible to think that Henry Barry was responsible for all these things that were committed. But we are fairly certain that he himself murdered Brantley Harris, not merely, again, in retaliation for the death of his cousins, but in retribution for the years and years of punishment that Harris had inflicted on both Indian men and women.
And I would just want to point out, too, that before that, and in fact, after that, Henry Lowry was honored in the Lumbee community and in the white community. He had white friends that he hunted with. In fact, I met a lady in Davidson, North Carolina, a couple of years ago who told me that her husband's grandfather had been Henry's best friend, white man, and that they hunted together, and that the story passed down in the family was that, really, it was essentially one sentence, which other people have said, too. Henry Barry was a man of honor. That's what her husband's grandfather had told her, and that's how he was perceived. He was also unusually good-looking and talented. He was a master carpenter. So he was seemed to be the inheritor of his father's reputation and his father's position in the community.
Mm-hmm. And was there's a legend, too, that there was an execution that Henry may have witnessed that was all sort of part of this.
The execution was not a legend.
It was real.
That was certainly real. Whether or not Henry witnessed it is unclear. But what happened was that his father's reputation was so significant in the Indian community and the white community that once the chaos of the war and these raids began occurring, the Confederacy saw him as a natural target in a way for their kind of last gasps at retaining power. So he was accused of stealing, of orchestrating. He was 75 years old at the time. Let's not forget that. He himself probably had not ridden to the widow McNair's and gunned down all these Confederates. But he was accused of coordinating these thefts and of stealing and owning personal property that in fact belonged to others. And on March 3rd, 1865, a Friday, a home guard detachment was sent to his house and basically rounded up him and his son Calvin, who was at home, his other son William, and his wife, his two sisters, and another house guest, and took them to a different farm, to the McKenzie plantation. Now, Robert McKenzie's smokehouse had just been robbed, by whom we're not sure, but he was convinced that it was by Henry Barry Lowry. And McKenzie, at his plantation, had another probably 75 white men waiting to meet this detachment of 25 home guard officers and the Lowry family. And on that day, that sort of mock trial was held because there was very little Confederate authority in the civil government in Robeson County. This group of home guardsmen decided that they were going to do the job of punishing whatever crimes Allen Lowry thought he had committed. And so they held this mock trial and eventually decided to execute Allen and his son William. And they, meanwhile, had locked everyone else in the Lowry family that they had found at the home that day into the smokehouse, which was now empty. And drove Allen and William back to the Lowry home and shot them. Legend is that they dug their own graves and then were fired upon and fell into their graves, were hastily covered up. And the home guard rode back to the McKenzie plantation. Well, they spent the next 3 days interrogating Mary and the other sons that they had captured at that time about where Henry Barry was, where were the escaped Union soldiers, where was all this other supposedly stolen property. And only after 3 days of staying in a locked in a dark smokehouse were people released. And it happened to be the same day they were released that Sherman crossed the Lumber River. And that's why we think that they decided to let them go without any further punishment, was because there was another job to be done, and it was to try to deal with Sherman's depredations in Lumberton, the county seat.
And this marks the start of the so-called Lowry War. I mean, what is that, and who are the soldiers in this war?
Well, the main protagonists are Henry Barry and his maternal kin, his kinfolks, cousins, brothers-in-law on his mother's side of the family, as well as Rhoda's side of the family. Rhoda's two brothers, Boss and Andrew, were close friends of Henry's as well and deeply involved in the gang's activities for the next 7 years. The mission of the war was to exact revenge on all of the people who had been responsible for the executions of Allen and William Lowry. I shouldn't neglect also that Zach McLaughlin, who we talked about earlier, a white neighbor of theirs, was a member of the gang for several years. They also had two African Americans, or three.
How big was the gang at its largest?
It varied. Its largest was about 9 or 12, somewhere along there. Henry Barry had a lot of brothers. I mean, Allen and Mary had 12 children, and Allen had another 5 or 7 from his first wife. So he had a lot of kinfolks to get involved in this kind of process. And it really represents, to me, a very sort of traditional way of approaching justice from the perspective of American Indians, especially those of us in the South who tend to trace our kinship through our mother's lines. We do it on both our mother's and father's lines now, but several hundred years ago, kinship was traced through your mother's line. And so when any kind of injustice had occurred, it was up to the men in your mother's family to exact the penalty for that injustice. And Henry Barry was essentially following in that tradition, and all of his maternal relatives, male relatives, got involved as well, partly because they had a personal stake, but also because it was about family loyalty, and it was about what needed to be done. And there were two or three African Americans who saw the same picture and took responsibility as well.
Well, and Josephine, one of the people Henry and his gang would murder was a local leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Can you tell us about John Taylor? Is that right?
That's his name.
John Taylor, I omitted from my novel. there were so many killings during this 7 years that it was too many for a novel. Yeah. It's an interesting problem.
How many of the gang were taken during
all
this time,
of them eventually.
But were they one at a time, or did they get rounded up?
One at a time. And and there were other Indians killed during that same time.
That had nothing to do with the gang, except were perhaps related to gang members or gang members' wives. For example, this leader of the KKK, John Taylor, was accused of killing a man named Make Sanderson. Make Sanderson was married to Henderson Oxendine's sister, and was therefore just sort of guilty by association. And John Taylor legendarily, when he was sort of passing sentence on Make, said something like, if I could expel all of the mulatto blood from Robeson County with my foot, I would do it. And then he kicked Make in the face. And, of course, at that time, Indians, some of them were thought of as quote-unquote mulattoes, because mulatto in the 19th century and earlier could mean anyone of white and non-white ancestry. And the nature of racial identity in Robeson County was quite complex, but the Lumbee Indians are not Indians by virtue of some kind of blood purity. Blood purity is a white supremacist notion that we wouldn't subscribe to. What we subscribe to is that we have a kinship, family and affiliation, and a strong attachment to our homeland, and a political bond that makes us Indian people and an Indian tribe. And that was what people like John Taylor didn't understand. They could only see the world in terms of racial hierarchy. And by killing someone who was innocent, like Make, was the expression of that total lack of regard for humanity, really. And so Henry Barry, again, with all due deliberance, said, well, I will execute John Taylor. And a couple of weeks later, again, he didn't rush to anything. A couple of weeks later, early in the morning, John was walking with his father-in-law right past a pond that his father-in-law owned. It's in a community called Moss Neck now. And you can go today and see where the pond was, where the bridge was that they were walking over. And his father-in-law heard a gunshot and felt a bullet graze his cheek and looked suddenly and saw that his son-in-law had dropped to the ground and that his head had exploded and his brains were scattered over the pond. And then he looked the other way and saw Henry Berry standing at the edge of the woods, probably 10, 15 yards away. I mean, Henry Berry had literally stepped out of the woods, aimed, shot John Taylor, and they had never, William McNeil, his father-in-law, never knew what happened. And from that point on, Henry Berry really became known, I think, as someone who was not to be messed with.
We will find out the rest of the story as we continue our conversation today with Melinda Maynard Lowry and Josephine Humphreys about Allumbee Civil War folk hero Henry Berry Lowry, part of our North Carolina Voices series on the Civil War. Stay with the State of Things. Coming right back. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasia. My guest this hour, Melinda Maynard Lowry, writer and UNC history professor, and novelist Josephine Humphreys, talking today about Henry Berry Lowry, his tale of struggle, revenge, justice, during and after the Civil War in Robeson County. Melinda, tell us about how Henry met his end.
Well, Henry is himself is somewhat of a mystery about what happened. In 1872... the bank in Lumberton had just been robbed of $25,000, which was a huge amount of money, almost unimaginable amount of money.
That's a lot of money to have in one place.
At that time. And
yeah,
it's
a
lot of money. Millions today, right? And a couple of days after that robbery, Henry Berry was reported as dead. And the story that was issued was that he had accidentally shot himself while cleaning his gun. Now, that's also the story that his descendants believe, because their grandmother, great-grandmother, his daughter, Henry Berry's daughter Polly, told them that. Of course, that's what she had been told. There was no way, I think, that Henry Berry would have allowed his female family members to know the truth, because that would have put them at great vulnerability from the people who were pursuing him. Meanwhile, it could have been true. That could have been what happened to him. But the also story that has circulated more prominently throughout the Lumbee community is that he left the county, that he disappeared. He found a way out, essentially. And it was through that legend that we are able to tell stories about Henry Berry's ghost returning to Robeson County and visiting Rhoda's grave, that people tell stories about Rhoda receiving letters from Henry later on in the 19th century, 20 years after this conflict. The only person member of the gang who did meet his end by legal means was Henderson Oxendine, my great-great-grandfather. And he was executed in 1871. The story that was passed down in my family was that Henderson essentially gave himself up. And this makes sense because, you know, the gang had successfully eluded the authorities. I mean, you know, the militia, state militia, the equivalent of the National Guard was sent down to try to find Henry Barry Lowry and dispatch him. And for years, everyone had escaped capture while also living in plain sight. Henry Barry and his band members would ride the railroad.
The train back and forth.
Back and forth across Robeson County unmolested, essentially. They'd have parties where Henry would play the banjo and the fiddle, and Henderson would sing. Henderson was known as a great singer. So the idea that he gave himself up resonates somewhat for me as a historian as well as one of his descendants, because it was just simply too easy. He was captured after spending the night at his sister's house, and they never stayed in one place any long enough to be caught, but Henderson apparently decided that this was the moment. And it was our family tradition that he did that in order so that the families of the gang members could live in some kind of peace, that he felt if the authorities got some of what they wanted, that maybe things would be a little bit easier for everyone else.
Well, but he was charged with the murder of the sheriff, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I understood that he was not even there.
He wasn't even there.
No.
I think everyone understood that, but the authorities really needed at the time a scapegoat.
Would you read for us, Josephine, from your book, Nowhere Else on Earth?
Sure. I'm going to read a section that happens after Henderson is hanged. Rhoda takes her children to the hanging. Hangings were public spectacles at the time, and everybody turned out in Lumberton for it. And I'm not going to read that actual scene because it's really, I can't read it. It's too
it's kind of painful.
Painful and awful. But
I will say that Henderson sang two songs from the gallows. He didn't give any kind of speech.
He sang Amazing Grace. Methodist hymn.
And another Methodist hymn called As Can I Yet Delay, which is basically about the wish to delay death to stay with one's loved ones, but can't do it, you know.
So this is just Rhoda speculating about Henderson's death. And whenever Rhoda speculates, that's me speculating too. So she says, Henderson's sons would go on to start big families of their own, and even if they never bore his name, for he hadn't lived long enough to marry, and the boys would always be Johnny and James Cummings, and all their boys would be named Cummings. Still, they all knew they were Henderson Oxendine's line. Johnny and James stood by their mother when the luck stone was rolled onto the grave at the Sandcut Burying Ground to be Henderson's own and only marker. Until years later, when another Cummings might have a granite headstone set there and inscribed. But as long as the old stone stays, I will take my children to that burying ground every year, and then I'll take my grandchildren. We'll stand under the trees, and I'll tell them, the old ones are all around us. They were quiet people. A man had a man's place, and a woman had a woman's place, and they worked themselves to death for a crop of puny corn, but they were strong. I can't tell you where they came from. They were just here. It is important to tell children everything you know, even if it's not the whole story, because someday someone will put it all together. And I say to them, this is the grave of Henderson Oxendine, last man hanged by the state of North Carolina. He was loyal to Henry Barry and never betrayed him, not even to get rich and save his own life. These trees are saddle tree poplars. This rock is like no other, but grows in the earth for 1,000 years, and then when the time is right, it rises and is found.
Josephine Humphreys reading from her novel, Nowhere Else on Earth. Tell me about researching this and how much of the, first of all, how much time did you spend?
I spent 10 years researching and writing this book, and there there was more material to be found than I had expected, but it was still difficult to get at. And I was, this was pre-Google.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of traveling. I went to all the great big Southern University libraries and loved them. I had a great time. I went to a lot of little town libraries, in particular Lumberton, and found stuff there. And I just, it was sort of scattershot research because there was no telling where something might show up. I actually read a 1,000-page book of memoirs that I found in the South Carolina Historical Society and came across a real nugget that was printed, published nowhere else on earth. That was a white woman telling about her own grandmother who lived in Robeson County and saying, Granny's kitchen girl was Henry Lowry's wife. And that was not written anywhere else. I'd never seen it and haven't seen it since. But each little tiny thing that I found like that was like a magical thing to me. And I made it not only inspired me, but I used most of those little things. I found pictures that Rhoda had on her wall. And you know, they were little talismans for me.
And I guess luckily there was a fair amount of journalism around this.
There was a lot of newspaper activity. Mm-hmm. Henry and his gang were known all over the United States and even beyond. And the New York Herald actually sent reporters down here, and so did other newspapers too. And one of them interviewed Rhoda Strong. That's where I found out what the pictures were on her wall. Unfortunately, the Robeson County newspaper collection burned, and a lot of that was lost. I think
from that
there would
period,
have been
yeah.
some a lot more information if we had those papers. But it was always an adventure. It was a treasure hunt, I felt like I got enough.
And why a novel and not a nonfiction history about this period and his life?
Biography. Well, because I'm a fiction writer.
There you go.
And I also feel that, to me anyway, the aspect of the story that's the most important is not the facts, but the power of the story. And it seems clear to me that this is just a prime example of how a legend, and I'm not talking about whether it's true, you know, parts of it being true or not, but a story, a central story of a hero, holds a community together. The story of Henry Barry Lowry is something that every Lumbee child, grown up, and elderly person knows. Mm-hmm. And it really, in the absence of, let's say, federal recognition as an Indian tribe, the story is one of the things that is the glue for the community.
Yeah. And you know, a legend on a map is a guide, right? And that's what this story is for us. It's a kind of moral guide, a compass in a way, that tells us. I mean, I remember first hearing the story from my mother as we were, I think I was probably 8 or 9 or something, and we were looking at a genealogy chart, and she was telling me who was in it. She told me about Henderson. Mm-hmm. She told me about Henry Barry. Told me what they were and who they were, what they did. And she didn't then say, "Well, daughter, this is what you are now supposed to do as a Lumbee." Mm-hmm. But it was clear from her life example and from that of my father and from that of my grandparents that their lives and their values were consistent with the stories that we tell about ourselves. And this is one of the, if not the central story.
What does a story like this do for you as a historian? Obviously, this is a personal story. It's a family story. It's a cultural story about your people. And you're a professional historian. So what happens to you? What does this story do inside that well-educated head?
It makes me very emotional at times.
It grows.
Yeah. It gets bigger and bigger. It makes me ask harder and harder questions of history, I think, of the past. Because when you look at the social class and racial and gender dynamic of Robeson County at this time, it's really the fabric of North Carolina and of America that we're talking about. You know, we remember our past as this kind of division between races or division between classes that gets resolved or not. But what Nowhere Else on Earth talks about and what the story is a representation of how people lived together who had sometimes enormously different values and conceptions of each other, but they created a world in which all had to survive. And this is the world that Lumbees continue to inhabit. And it's the kind of story that, as a historian, you know, I need to return to again and again, because it keeps reminding me that the past is not a simple narrative, certainly not a simple narrative of progress, but also not a narrative of good versus evil.
Is the story relevant to life in Robeson County, North Carolina today?
In lots of ways. I mean, I won't say nothing's changed. A lot of things have changed in terms of the power of Indian and black people in Robeson County today. It's quite different than it was at that time. Nevertheless, we still find reasons for people to address injustices. And one of the things you still hear Lumbee people, especially older people, say today, well, if Henry Barry had seen that, he'd never have put up with that, you know.
That's right.
There should have been a Henry Barry here to address that problem. So the legend lives on in that sense. But the racial, cultural, and social dynamics that we have in the county today are fraught, mostly because poverty is our main problem. And this economic system we live under now doesn't value folks like the Lowrys or the white families or the black families who grew more than they needed so they could give to others. That's simply not the economic world we live in anymore, and nobody rewards that. So it creates a huge problem, not just for poor people in Robeson County of all races, but for everybody.
It seems to me, too, that his story and the legend itself points to the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses, too, in all of the arguments that supported white supremacy, supported the institutions of slavery itself. But white society and also a native society. I mean, obviously, this revenge culture really doesn't – it's not very productive over time, and there has to be a way to sit down and reconcile those differences, because the revenge culture leaves you with nobody.
Well, that's
time.
Right.
So all of those
vulnerabilities. I have a completely different point of view because I'm not part of the Lumbee community, and the story's new. But I have never thought of it as a revenge culture, even though I know that that was the motive for the killings. There was reason for the killings. But I think that when a group has been marginalized and had rights removed and is starving to death, that this is going to happen no matter what.
And you have this great line that you write about Rhoda's mother, C. Joe says that C was nice until the point that niceness becomes impossible. And that is the perfect characterization of Lumbee women in general, but also of the people as a whole and what they had been through. I think the revenge culture, Henry Barry Lowry embodied the fact that it was not rash. It was the result of decades, or, and when you put it in the colonial perspective, of centuries of marginalization that Lumbee people and our ancestors had experienced. And for that reason, this was going to happen no matter who exacted it.
And, you know, when I first started writing, and the title of this book comes from my initial approach as an outsider, white person, wondering what's going to happen, who these people are. And so the title means, this is a unique place, nowhere else on earth. By the time I finished,
including a documentary, Civil War, diversity.